What's my subscription to the New York Times have me doing this week? Preparing a strawberry pretzel pie. Solving spelling bee with no hints. Planning a trip to one of the 52 best places to go. Getting to the bottom of the big pants trend.
Whoa.
And I'm finally replacing my vacuum with a recommendation I can trust. What will your subscription to the Times have you do? Why not find out? With our best offer, go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, at the latest hearing in Washington, Attorney General Jeff Sessions calls the suggestion that he colluded with Russians a detestable lie and refuses to discuss his private conversations with President Trump. And more than 40 women have accused Bill Cosby of sexual assault. All but one of them ran out of time to press charges. It's Wednesday, June 14th.
I'm here today to address several issues that have been specifically raised before this committee. And I appreciate the opportunity to respond to questions as fully as the Lord enables me to do so.
On Tuesday, it was Attorney General Jeff Sessions' turn to appear before the Senate Intelligence Committee investigating Russian interference in the 2016 election. Matt Apuzzo.
Yes.
This is the first time we're hearing from Attorney General Jeff Sessions about the Russia investigation. What was his message?
I'm here. I'm doing my job. I'm not in cahoots in any sort of Russian conspiracy.
And the suggestion that I participated in any collusion, that I was aware of any collusion with the Russian government to hurt this country, which I have served with honor for 35 years, or to undermine the integrity of our democratic process, is an appalling and detestable lie.
And he was ticked. He was ticked off at the idea that they would suggest that.
So remind us why Jeff Sessions was asked to testify in the first place. What are the questions surrounding him in the Russia investigation?
There's a lot going on, right? So
you recused yourself from the Russia investigation, yet you participated in the firing of Mr. Comey.
Why were you involved in the firing of the FBI director, Jim Comey?
We'll want to ask you about how you view your recusal and whether you believe you've complied with it fully.
Are you still involved in the Russia investigation? Did you have a secret meeting?
Questions have also been raised about some of your own interactions with Russian officials during the campaign. During your confirmation hearing in January, you said, quote, "You did not have communications with Russians." Despite that, the fact is, as we discovered later, that you did have interactions with Russian government officials during the course of the campaign. In March, you acknowledged two meetings with the Russian ambassador. Yet, there's also been some public reports of a possible third meeting at the Mayflower Hotel.
Let's focus on the Russian contacts.
Yes.
And those questions.
Yes,
first.
I have been obsessed with that for months. There has been this story out there, like floating in the D.C. ether, that maybe there's this third meeting.
I did not have any private meetings, nor do I recall any conversations with any Russian officials at the Mayflower Hotel. I did not attend any meetings at that event separate.
And to tell you how obsessed the Justice Department has been in trying to run this down, the communications director of the Justice Department has gone around and interviewed people who were there and interviewed Sessions' former staff person and said things like, did you leave his side? Did you go to the bathroom?
Hmm.
Did you get a drink?
Why? Why so
well,
much
Because
intrigue.
The thing is if he gets caught having had a secret meeting with Kislyak, I mean, his credibility is shot, right? Because he's already had to go back once to the Senate and say, oh, you know what? There were two meetings with the Russian ambassador. If you go and say there aren't, and then it turns out there is a third meeting, I mean, it could be catastrophic for the Trump administration, which has constantly had to change its story about who met with the Russians and when.
Matt, I was struck by the number of senators on this committee who asked Jeff Sessions, can you tell us what the president has said to you about Russia and about the Russia investigations? And Sessions essentially said, no, I won't.
Attorney General Sessions, has the president ever expressed his frustration to you regarding your decision to recuse yourself?
Senator Heinrich, I'm not able to share with this committee private communications.
Because you're invoking executive privilege.
I'm not able to.
What was Sessions' explanation for not answering?
In a nutshell, he basically said, I'm preserving the president's right to assert executive privilege.
And what exactly is executive privilege?
It's basically the president's privilege under the Constitution to have private counsel from his advisors. And it's a limited privilege. It's not like they're not priests, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you're compelled to give testimony, you know, there's case law that says, you know, in some instances that the president's privilege can be outweighed and can basically be overturned. But they didn't even really assert it. And that's kind of what drove all the Democrats crazy.
Has the president invoked executive privilege in the case of your testimony here today?
He has not.
Then what is the basis of your refusal to answer these questions?
Senator Kaine, the president has a constitutional...
I understand that, but the president hasn't asserted it.
Is it the case that a senior member of the Trump administration can just not answer questions from the Senate?
Well, he just did, so we know yet, right? Well, yes, that happened today.
So you mentioned James Comey.
Yes.
And this testimony...
Once or twice.
This testimony came about a week after Comey testified before the exact same committee and talked a lot about Jeff Sessions, the attorney general.
I asked former FBI director whether your role in firing him violated your recusal, given that President Trump said he fired Comey because of the Russian investigation. Director Comey said this was a reasonable question. So I want to ask you just point blank, why did you sign the letter recommending the firing of Director Comey when it violated your recusal?
It did not violate my recusal.
What did Sessions say about why he could be both recused from the Russia investigation and recommend the firing of James Comey?
Well, Sessions says, well, I fired him because of his general performance issues, including his handling of the Hillary Clinton investigation last year. And, you know, my recommendation that he be fired had nothing to do with any particular investigation.
That would be the answer to that. And the letter that I signed represented my views that had been formulated for some time.
Mr. Chairman, just if I can finish, that answer, in my view, doesn't pass the smell test. The president tweeted repeatedly about his anger at investigations into his associates in Russia. The day before you wrote your letter, he tweeted that the collusion story was a total hoax and asked, when will this taxpayer-funded charade end? I don't think your answer passes the smell test.
Well, Senator, why not?
This is why when the president goes out and just says, yeah, I fired him. I was thinking about the Russia investigation when I fired him. Because now Sessions is forced to answer, like, well, were you part of some sort of cover-up, or were you part of some sort of ruse where, you know, you would write a pretextual justification for firing him when, wink, wink, we all know that it's about Russia. And the president of the United States' comments have caused this problem for his attorney general.
Do you believe that it would have been better for you to have stayed out of the decision to fire Director Comey?
I think it's my responsibility. I mean, I was appointed to be attorney general. Supervising all the federal agencies is my responsibility. Trying to get the very best people in those agencies at the top of them is my responsibility. And I think I had a duty to do so.
Matt, did we learn anything new from this testimony about the larger question here of whether there was collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government?
Not at all, right? I mean, if you're looking at the past week of hearings on the Hill and you are narrowly focused on was there collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, you've essentially learned nothing. But if you consider the Russia story to include how the president of the United States acted in the face of an investigation, then you did learn stuff. But your view on the past week in Washington, frankly, like your view on every week in Washington, probably depends on what your views are on the president of the United States.
Matt, thank you.
All right. Thanks, man.
We'll be right back.
My name is Jasmine Ulloa, and I'm a national politics reporter for The New York Times. I grew up in Texas, on the border with Mexico, and I've been reporting in the region since I was in high school. Now I travel the country looking for stories and voices that really capture what immigration and the nation's demographic changes mean for people. What I keep encountering is that voters don't fall into neat ideological boxes on this very volatile issue. There's a lot of gray. And that's where I feel the most interesting stories are. I'm trying to bring that complexity and nuance to our audience, especially in such a critical election year. And that's really what all of my colleagues on the politics team and every journalist at the New York Times is aiming to do. Our mission is to help you understand the world, no matter how complicated it might be. If you want to support this mission, consider subscribing to the New York Times. You can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
My name is Victoria Valentino, and I met Bill Cosby in 1969.
My name is Joyce Emmons. I met Bill Cosby in 1978.
My name is Barbara Bowman. I was introduced to Bill Cosby when I was 17 by my agent.
In late 2014, dozens of women began to come forward one by one to say that Bill Cosby had sexually assaulted them, more than 40 in all.
I'm Louisa Moritz. When I met Mr. Cosby, I was on The Tonight Show. I was in my dressing room.
My name is Lily Bernard. In the early 1990s, in my mid-20s, Bill Cosby mentored me. He gained my total trust. And then he drugged me without my knowledge. He raped me.
I was drugged and raped.
I know that I was drugged.
I was sexually assaulted and drugged by him.
And he put a pill next to my wine glass.
He opened the door. He never knocked.
And I said, you know I don't do drugs. Don't give me anything strong. And he said, no, would I do that to my friend? I would never hurt you.
More than 2 years later, just one of those cases has gone to trial in Norristown, Pennsylvania, where jurors have entered their third day of deliberations.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
My colleague Graham Boley is covering it from the courthouse. It's amazing. After all these women came forward, the case is built around just one of them. Can you tell me more about this one woman, Andrea Constant? What's her account? What's her story?
She's here, of course, and since she's testified, she's been sitting on the front row. She's a very striking figure. She's 6 feet tall. She has a big shock of hair. She was a basketball star and played basketball at college, and she ended up at Temple University in Philadelphia as director of operations for the Temple women's basketball team. And it was there in 2002, just several months after she'd arrived, that she first met the most famous man associated with Temple, Bill Cosby.
What is the assault that she alleges? What does she describe as happening?
So I think they both sort of agree there were about three occasions when they were alone at his house in the Philadelphia suburbs. And on the first two occasions, she said he did try advances and she rebuffed them. He described those first two as sort of, you know, petting and touching. But then this third occasion, January, they think, she goes to his home. She's worried about her career. She's thinking of leaving Temple University. And they enter the kitchen at the home. And they talk about these problems, her problems, career, lack of sleep. And he goes upstairs and comes back with three pills, which he says, take these. These will help. These are your friends. He calls them your friends. Mm-hmm. And she takes them. She says that she asked him whether they were herbal, and Bill Cosby said they were. But about 20 minutes, half an hour after that, she began to blur her vision. She couldn't stand. She felt paralyzed, and he helped her, she said, to the couch in the house and was there sexually assaulted and wakes up about 4 a.m. with her clothes disheveled, and he's there in the doorway, and she kind of leaves. That's her account of the night. He describes it differently as a very cozy evening together. Not particularly romantic because he just leaves her on the couch, but which the prosecutors made much of. But he sort of sees it as this sort of culmination of a romantic relationship. And that's why we're here today.
What is the heart of Cosby's defense in this case?
It was consensual. He doesn't deny this extramarital affair. Yesterday, his wife came to the court for the first time. And at one very dramatic moment, Bill Cosby's lawyer, Brian McMonagall, turned to Bill Cosby and just shouted, "You danced outside the marriage," and turned to Camille.
His own lawyer said that.
Yes, yes. And turned to Camille and said, "You know, and you deserve better." So there's no hiding the fact that he was this serial, you know, we know from the deposition he was a serial pursuer of women. And they talked about it. His lawyer talked about it yesterday, this sort of disillusionment, and, you know, as these heroes we once had, and finally we grow up and we see them for who they are. None of us are perfect. But there's a big difference between that and drugging somebody. And they say this was consensual, and Andrea Constant was a participant in a consensual romantic relationship.
Is there any dispute between both Bill Cosby and Andrea Constant about the pills that he gave her?
Absolutely. She, and a lot of the trial has been about the identity of these pills. She said he said they were herbal. He says he never told her what they were. Several months later, when Andrea and her mother call from Canada to confront Mr. Cosby, he won't say what they are to begin with. And we hear these phone calls played because Andrea's mother recorded at least one of them.
Wow.
And we hear his voice in court, and he won't tell her what they are. And that had an earlier conversation where we wasn't recorded, we couldn't hear, where he'd said, "Wait a minute," and he goes away and looks at the bottle and comes back and says, "I can't read it because of his eyes. I'll mail it to you." When, you know, she goes to the police a few weeks later, from that call, he says they're Benadryl. The other drug that's been mentioned big time in this trial is Quaaludes. The prosecution aren't saying they're necessarily Quaaludes or the necessary Benadryl, but they did bring experts into the court, an expert into the court who talked about both drugs could have the effect that Andrea Constant described.
What has stood out to you, any particular moments during the trial?
The main event was Andrea Constant's testimony. Without corroborating evidence, it's all about whether the jury believe her. So one of the things that stood out was the heated arguments, the back and forth about her interactions with Mr. Cosby after the alleged assault, in the 3 months after the alleged assault in early 2004, when they showed there were numerous phone calls between Andrea Constant and Mr. Cosby. And then just a few months after the alleged assault, she takes her family to see a show of Mr. Cosby's, and her family takes a gift to this show to give to Mr. Cosby. "These are not the actions of a sexual assault victim," said the defense. She said she did stay in touch because he was the most famous benefactor of Temple University, and she worked for Temple University. So she was taking his call. She was calling him back. She was being a dutiful employee, and she did take her family because she didn't want to tell them what happened. She was a sex assault victim who was spending these months just coming to terms with having been assaulted, she said, by a friend.
I wonder what Bill Cosby's demeanor has been throughout all of this.
Each day he comes in, helped by his aide. Each day he's had supporters, an actress from The Cosby Show. Finally, his wife came into court on Monday. But despite these supporters, he's cut quite a lonely figure, I think, and he sits right at the front on the right-hand side near the judge at the table. He's fighting blindness. He sort of stares ahead. It's not clear what he's seeing. He has a cane, and he's always helped by his aide, who leads him around the courtroom. He doesn't really react. Even when Andrea Constant was testifying, he did frown, he did look down. Even during these sort of very graphic recountings of, in his own words, of what happened, he sort of stares straight ahead. Andrea Constant is in the room now, and she sits on the front row. It's not clear whether she can see him because there's a big screen there used for projecting papers for the jury to see. But she's there. And there are today there are four. There have been some of the other women accusers sit in a row near the back of the court, you know, staring out at him. I'm not sure if he can see them. Occasionally, you know, in the evenings, he looks tired now, actually, but he seemed a bit energized by the attention, and he has to walk out past the kind of rows of reporters, and he plays to them. He did a Fat Albert hey, 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 and pretended to stumble and waves his cane around. So occasionally he'll crack a joke, I think much to the consternation of his lawyers. But mainly he looks tired, and, you know, I think he looks very lonely.
And what are the charges in this trial that you've been covering?
three counts of aggravated indecent assault, each count to do with that night of alleged drugging and assault. And each count carries a maximum of 10 years.
No matter what the verdict is, what do you think that this case is ultimately about? What's the larger significance?
I think one is the treatment of sex assault victims. You know, as many of these women have come forward in such huge numbers, they were denied the chance to even get into court by the statute of limitations. Mm-hmm. And we've heard in this case, around this case, in this trial even, experts talking about how it's impossible often for women to come forward, or any abused person to come forward and speak about it immediately, especially if it's somebody they know. And so the law puts them into this box that they cannot meet, and they're denied at least an attempt at justice in court. And so some of the women who are not part of this case but have argued in a number of states to extend the statute of limitations, and so that they can take longer to come forward to bring their allegations. It's not saying they're going to be proved true, but at least they get a chance in court.
The other women who you say have shown up in the courtroom and who are watching or maybe watching from afar, could this be a symbolic verdict for them?
Yeah, it is. Their hopes are being carried on this trial. They're wearing badges today, some of them. We stand in truth. They see, you know, Andrew is almost a proxy for them. They were denied their own time in court to prove their case. But Andrew is allowed in, and they hope that any victory for Andrew here will be a victory for them, some sort of valediction of their own hurt, as they describe it, their own stories from many years ago.
Graham, thank you very much. We'll be in touch as the jury keeps deliberating.
Yeah. Okay, Michael, thanks very much.
Here's what else you need to know today.
As far as I'm concerned, yes, Senator, I appointed him. I stand by that decision. I think it was the right thing to do under those circumstances. And I'm going to defend the integrity of that investigation.
In a separate congressional hearing on Tuesday, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein took questions from senators concerned about recent reports that President Trump is considering firing Robert Mueller.
If President Trump ordered you to fire the special counsel, what would you do?
Senator, I'm not going to follow any orders unless I believe those are lawful and appropriate orders. Under the regulation, Special Counsel Mueller may be fired only for good cause, and I am required to put that cause in writing. And so that's what I would do. If there were a good cause, I would consider it. If there were not good cause, it wouldn't matter to me what anybody says.
Rosenstein did not rule out the possibility that Mueller could be fired, which a friend of the president has said is under discussion. And the co-founder and chief executive of Uber, Travis Kalanick, is taking a leave of absence after mounting complaints about the aggressive tactics and culture he used to build the company. The decision came on the same day that Uber's board of directors adopted a series of recommendations to improve its relationship with employees, following allegations of sexism, harassment, and violence in its corporate offices. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.